Production. Recorded live.
Well, is anybody on the call yet? Aaron?
Are you there?
Yeah, I'm here.
Okay.
Is Erin here yet?
No, it doesn't look like it.
Okay. She should be there in a second. So, Wendy?
Yes.
Is Denny on the call too?
Not yet.
Okay. Let's wait about one more minute. Aaron was supposed to come on and until I get back to a computer, I'm still about 10 minutes from a computer. She's going to read questions for me.
Oh, Denny's here now.
I'm going to text her real quick. Hang on a second.
Okay.
Hello?
Denny?
Yep.
The call has started, but we're waiting for Aaron.
Okay.
Did she come while I was doing that?
No.
Okay, good. Well, I just texted her.
I have my eyes peeled.
You have your what?
I have my eyes healed on my computer.
Ah, okay, good. Well, I should have mine peeled on my computer in just a few moments. Just got to get back there. Okay, here she comes.
Here she comes.
We made it. Was that you, Erin?
No, it's not showing up yet.
Okay, well, she said she was almost in, so I don't know what that means.
There, I just looked. There she is.
Okay.
By computer, but not the phone. Yeah. Oh, she's coming. She's coming. There she is.
Hello. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Great.
Hey, Erin.
All right. So, are you ready for your questions, Rick?
I'm ready for the first question, madam.
Okay, well, this one is one that Wendy posted, but I know that Wendy has a Harboring Hope group and Married for Life, so she says this is another one posted by committee. So she says, could you describe the hop over to pretend normal and why it doesn't work, even though it might look appealing to one or both partners at various times? Also, could you explain how working through the infidelity benefits not only the hurt spouse, but the unfaithful spouse? So it sounds like you've got two very different questions.
Yeah. Okay, so the first one is pretend normal and what's the harm in it?
Yeah. And why it doesn't work.
Oh, why it won't work?
Right.
Well, I mean, in a sense, pretend normal potentially could work for a while, and it might even work for the rest of someone's life. I've got someone right now that he's 66 years old, and I think if they did pretend normal, they don't want to, but if they did, since, you know, he seems to act out about once every 20 years, you know, if his cycle holds true, I mean, he might go another 20 years, and so that'd make him 86, and, you know, the probabilities of him acting out again probably would be pretty small. The problem with pretend normal, though, is that it leaves, in terms of relapse prevention, it's awful, simply because it never really addresses the issue, and it allows the individual or the couple to ultimately it's almost like you don't put the part, you don't deal with the part that's causing this thing in the first place, because you're saying it's you're denying it, and by denying it, you really don't, you know, you continue to try to live life the same way, which means that the probabilities of relapse go up significantly. Einstein says that, one of my favorite quotes I've heard this last month was just that you can never solve a problem by the same consciousness that created it. And what pretend normal does is it allows an individual to continue trying to live life basically with the same viewpoint and the same techniques that got them there in the first place. And it's ultimately, it'll never solve the problem. In the long run, it only continues or perpetuates the probabilities of that problem occurring again. There has to be some sort of transformation or a shift in, you know, what you think you're about or what you think this is about, but you begin to live with an awareness that this is honestly a possibility, and as long as you know that you're not pretending it's not a possibility, then you can live with you can develop or live a life in the solution
where you do what's necessary to keep from this occurring again. However, you know, I think that with pretend normal, pretend normal is really just a whole nother word, another way of saying denial, too. That's the other thing, that we've got to be able to be honest with what we're capable of, what our defects of character are. You know, we kind of want to be able to mature and grow up, and pretend normal does allow us to avoid having to address the stuff, but it never solves any of the issues. So, I that's why I think that it's dangerous. It's just that the probabilities of relapse continue, and we never grow up. I mean, it's not the process by which we'll get stronger. The other thing that some people, though, the reason they don't like, or that they do like pretend normal, is they don't understand the concept of maybe grace and mercy, and they still live in a system that's always based on that your value is based on having to be good enough. And with normal, you know, at least I can appear to be good. And sometimes when people try to face the problem because they don't understand grace, and it, you know, they live in a system, I think, that doesn't work, one of performance, there's too much shame involved, or they may feel a great deal of shame if they feel like that, you know, they're even, that they have a potential of ever doing this again. They think that something must be wrong with them. The reality is all of us are broken creatures. None of us are perfect. And we're all, the one way we know we're capable of doing something is because we've done it. I never know whether somebody who hasn't lost it in one way or the other, whether they're capable of, I think there's certain things I'm certainly not capable of doing. Now, I've never done them. I may never do them. And so I may not, those may not be my weaknesses. But, you know, if you've got a real problem with rage and anger, to sit there and begin to say, well, this isn't an issue for me, and even though you had a real problem with rage and anger in the past, somehow thinking that you'll never do it again, to me is just tantamount to denial. And the reality is that the way you break through that, are you, you know, you don't live in pretend normal, but you accept that it's a real possibility. You're willing to address it. You don't have to feel, you know, be ashamed of it. It's just the deck of cards or the hand of cards you've got to play. And so you've got to learn to play that hand of cards and have enough integrity to look at that and accept that, you know, my true self, who I am, you know, this isn't me, but it may be one of my defects of character. And I don't have to be perfect. And I think that there are certain maybe systems we live in that make having to be perfect or having to be good the main point, which I think that's a kind of a losing situation. That's why I say you've got to almost develop a different reason to live. And I hope that when we begin to face the issues and learn a different system, a new way of living, a new thing to pursue, a new goal, rather than being good, that's where things ultimately, where we're transformed and we become, I think, much more centered and become truly who we were made to be, but we don't have to pretend to be something we're not. That was probably a long, very confusing answer to everybody that's listening here or may hear this someday, but hopefully that helps a little bit.
No, it was a great answer. It was very helpful.
Now, the second half of that question was what now? Aaron, are you there?
Sorry, I thought I unmuted myself. Okay, it was, also, could you explain how working through infidelity benefits not only the hurt spouse, but the unfaithful spouse as well? Wendy,
okay, well,
do you feel like you already answered that one? I think you went a long way in answering that one as it is.
Well, I just think that working through the infidelity probably does more good in some ways for the, or as much good for the, for both spouses. I mean, for the unfaithful spouse, I mean, there's an enormous amount of freedom being able to be known and being able to be intimate and being able to be real. I mean, why wouldn't we want to kind of do that? And to me, like I say, I mean, I could never be loved unconditionally as long as I was only conditionally letting my mate know who I was. And so I fail in the marriage, but I guarantee you, if I am able to take an honest look at myself and begin to heal and to grow, and you still choose to love me and to be with me in the long run, that's a pretty astounding thing. And I think that you end up having a marriage that's much more authentic and flexible and capable of weathering the different storms of life for both parties. I think that, you know, it becomes a part of the story of who we are. And, you know, we become something, I think, very, very different. I mean, it's not like we're together because everything is good. And, I mean, once you face adversity, I think most couples that work through this have a much more profound relationship, because their marriage actually has more value to them now. And that story of us that's now become what we've worked through begins to even set an example for future generations. So I think there's a tremendous amount of benefit for both parties and for future generations when we're willing to kind of teach those that come behind us how to face life and how to deal with adversity, and ultimately that we can work through things. So what's the next question, madam? She's got to unmute herself again.
Do I have to unmute myself? I've got cats and dogs in the background. And the next question is, could you explain why sexual addiction is not something that just goes away by itself? What does a sex addict need to do to be in recovery and to help make the hurt spouse feel safe?
Okay, so we get into a really interesting thing when we start talking about sexual addiction. And the problem, like with alcohol or drugs or any addiction, there's so many different forms. I was talking to a woman this morning, and definitely fall into the sexual addiction piece, but it's not going to look anything like what most men would think sexual addiction looked like. It was much more a need for attention and just a chronic pattern of almost flirting and grooming. So, but it still, you know, takes more and more and more, and gets, it's still the, what causes the chemical high. And for the person that's truly an addict, they will come to a place in life where their natural, that addict in them is almost like, there is a compulsion, a pattern of response that when you get to a certain place, it's kind of like, wow, I could have a V8. I mean, it's the thing that pops into your head as the solution for life's problems, because the addict doesn't really know how to live life on life's terms. For whatever reason, because they're for bad, they've got this fear of being a disappointment, because they just are adrenaline junkies, for whatever reason, the just kind of living life straight up doesn't feel normal to them. So what their normal is whatever this behavior that they have, their chosen or their drug of choice, so to speak, is really kind of a default mode. So if they're bored, the default mode gets to be, hey, I could do this. Or in any given situation, if they're in a place where they used to act out, the first thing they'll begin to experience is that compulsion to do that again. For the addict, the compulsion to act that way actually may never fully go away. They may always feel the tug of the addict in them, of that old nature. It's just that, you know, if they're living for something very different, if it doesn't define them, if it's much more, if they're living kind of a different sort of life, a different sort of program, then in reality, they don't have to respond to that voice of the addict, but they're still going to or experience it. So I guess in terms of the question for the addict, I don't think if someone denies, and if they truly have an addiction, and they say this, you know, this is gone, I'm okay, I would never do this again, which would be back to denial to me and normal, then all they need is the right opportunities. They just need to get squeezed in life and things aren't going right. And I can promise you, when it's no longer pragmatically smart to live the other way, because if life isn't bringing them all the blessings they want, that impulse to act out will, I think, ping on the radar. And the problem with the addict, and this is another aspect of addiction, is, you know, like for the alcoholic, one is too many and 20 is not enough, because they don't control it. And if they do allow themselves to begin going down that path, then ultimately what will occur is it will take over again. I mean, it just takes up more and more of their thought process. And then they go into what I call living in the bubble, which is, now they're just thinking about when's the next time they're going to get to act out again, and they don't even live in the moment and in the present. They're just trying to figure out when's the next time they get to have their fix, whatever their fix is, whether it's seeing somebody at a gym, if it's a person, whether it's looking at porn, whether it's, you know, drinking or drugging. It makes no difference. The allure, you know, they just become very consumed with getting to do it again. So, you know, if an addict isn't aware, if they're truly an addict, to think that it's not going to come back is naive. And but if I live with the awareness that it always could come back, and I live with people around me, where I don't live in shame, it's not that I have to feel like there's something radically wrong with me. It's just my reality. And by accepting that, it actually can become my greatest asset, because it becomes the piece of life for me that allows me to live life very differently. So did I even answer that question through all of that, do you think?
Yes.
I mean, I hope so, because I don't want anybody... If they're really, and not everybody that acts out sexually, by the way, since we're here at the Affair Recovery Center, is an addict. I don't want, I think a lot of times just because someone has an affair, they think that maybe they have a sexual addiction. That is not the case. Some people have affairs, and they most definitely are not sex addicts. They have a problem now. But it's not sexual addiction, and I would also want to just delineate with that. So,
ready for the next question?
Ready for the next question.
All right, this is an interesting one. It is from Dennis, and he says, "This, I think, is one of the biggest stumbling blocks for unfaithful men." And then he says in quotes, "Why can't you just get over it? I said I'm sorry, and I won't ever do it again. What do you want from me? Of course, I don't think I ever said this out loud, but I sure did think it. How is this detrimental to recovery of the hurt spouse and to the unfaithful spouse as well?" So, Rick, what's
hang
wrong
on, just,
with saying...
Hang on just a second, Aaron.
Okay. It's a very good question, Dennis. Good job.
Thank you.
Oh, while I have you, I need to get your flight information, too, for your
oh,
flying
oh.
out stuff.
Okay.
So just email me when you get a chance. We don't want it recorded on the website.
We'll tell everyone.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, I'll send you the itinerary.
Are you going to be there, Aaron?
No, I'm not. I can't come to EMS
bad.
Very frequently. No, I live in Oklahoma, so... It's quite a trek for us to get down to EMS. They probably won't come again until next year. So I think Rick is, he has arrived at his office and he is, should be joining in under a different username.
Can you guys hear me okay?
I think so.
Good.
You sound a little bit far away from your mic.
Okay, well, I'll get up close to my mic.
Okay.
And let's see here. Just one more second.
I guess I'll hit refresh while I'm waiting and see. I know somebody snuck in a comment there right before we got on today because I was talking to Rick about an hour ago and I said, well, there are only 5 comments. And then I got on for this and there's 6. It was you, huh?
It was me.
I wish other people would take advantage
okay.
of this call. It seems like there's so few and I know there's so many members.
Well, and I know they have a lot of questions. That's why I get sent with them, though.
Yeah. Well, that's true. I guess you represent, what, 10 or 12 people probably with your questions.
Okay, Erin?
Okay.
You there?
Do you want me to read it again,
okay.
summarize for you?
No, I can see it now. You already read it, so
okay.
that's fine.
All right. So tell us, what's wrong with and what can you do about thinking? Why can't you just get over it? I said I'm sorry and I won't do it again.
Well, first off, I think that it's important for people to know that people do get over the intrusive thoughts, and they actually do come to a place where the whys aren't as important, and they do get beyond the fact that I will never be good enough. I think that there's a belief in the middle of the trauma and in the middle of all the hurt and the chaos that I can understand why people would think that might not happen. On the other hand, that's why we say it usually takes anywhere from 18 to 24 months before that becomes less and less relevant. And I know it to be true because, you know, as I talk to couples much farther down the line, I see it all the time. Now, but in the beginning, certainly those intrusive thoughts are there. And when they do come, it may be that it's not even the intrusive thoughts or the invasive thoughts is the problem, it's the amount of emotional turmoil that is actually triggered. I mean, if I have an invasive thought and it doesn't ping my emotional radar anymore, really, I won't even hardly notice the thought because it didn't even do anything. Like, I may sit there and think the name Martha, if, you know, Martha were an affair partner or whatever. You know, if I don't have emotion associated with that, the name Martha isn't going to even be considered an invasive thought because it's not going to capture me at that point. As couples heal, then the pain, if there is serious and true healing, the pain goes away. And so the intrusive thoughts really don't, first off, they don't even come as often, but second off, they don't capture you when they come because you're not going into an emotional turmoil as a result of that. Also, you know, I think one of the greatest things that can come from recovery here is that it will allow you as a hurt spouse to see yourself very differently because you do begin to understand that it's not about you. And I think that most of us grow not in the absence of pain and struggle and suffering, but actually in the midst of it. That as I look at it, God is usually in the midst of all the dung that's all around me. I mean, it's kind of the fertilizer in some very strange ways that caused me to move forward. And so I think that for the hurt spouse, that this is really an opportunity for them to be transformed to the point to where they actually feel even better about themselves than they've ever been able to feel, simply because they now understand kind of the metal and what they're made of. I remember my daughter once telling me when I was not all that pleased with somebody she brought home as a potential candidate for marrying, and I told her I didn't really like the guy, and she just said, well, you know, I know that if I marry him, that ultimately you would be able to get over it, but I don't know that Mom would ever be able to forgive me for marrying somebody she didn't approve of, at which point I just thought that was hysterically funny. And she said, why are you laughing? And I said, because until you know our story, you will never know what your mom is capable of doing and what your mom is capable of forgiving. And I think that probably some of Stephanie's best characteristics actually were revealed in the midst of the affair. And if we had never gone through that, I don't know that I could ever respect her the way I respect her, or she probably couldn't even respect herself the way she respects herself now, because we have faced, you know, a monster. And together and, you know, sometimes on our own, we dealt with that. But that transformed us. That began to change us. And it also let us know that we're capable and of handling things that we never thought probably could have handled. So that's why I think in the long run, it really does, you know, has the potential to really help someone. In the short run, though, the invasive intrusive thoughts are going to be really hard and bad, and I hope no one has to go through that. But if you're there, you know, I call it getting drugged through a knothole butt first. I mean, you don't have a lot of options, and, you know, you can either kind of take this thing and use it and learn from it, which I hope we do, because it would seem a pity to me that we go through something so horrible and, you know, there's no benefit. And I do think that the loss will be transformed, and that's what we wait for. And grieving helps with that. And so that's what the Harboring Hope, of course, I believe, helps with, and it's just how do you move beyond it. Okay, altering reality. One of the things that is so difficult to deal with in recovery, I don't know if it is particularly for spouses of sex addicts or hurt spouses in general, but the constant altering of reality that took place in the relationship. Now that we're in recovery, it's hard for me to judge reality because what I thought was real was not. It's a fairly large hump to get over, one of many large humps. How do I determine what is real? That's absolutely true, because for those of us who were unfaithful, especially if we were telling you that you were crazy for seeing what you were really seeing, it really does begin to make you question reality. And the first thing I think that begins to help you know reality is if your mate is honest with you and you begin to discover that much of what you thought was true. Now, if you had no clue whatsoever that anything was even going on, I think that it's just, then you have to have the courage to be able to look at what is reality and kind of readjust. Again, to do that, however, you still have to have your mate, I think, be willing to be honest so you can reassess all of those things. And that's a really tough one. Over time, again, I think if there's a continued connection between you and your mate, a continued pursuit of building on that relationship, a continued honesty, then I think that your reality is reestablished. But I think, you know, before you really trust it, it takes consistency over time, which is why in the trust article I just talked about, you know, it needs to be consistent like 9 times out of 10. It can't be consistent 56% of the time, or it's still that reality or that person still doesn't feel trustworthy. And hopefully over time we get to that place where the consistency is there so we can begin to believe it and know that it's real. The first 6 months. What does one do if the first months
in the first month when emotions run high and the unfaithful spouse is mourning the loss or potential loss of an affair partner. When the hurt spouse is trying to find her way and cope and is taken over by a flood of emotions and behaves in ways that do not make her feel good afterwards and knows it pushes the unfaithful spouse away.
Rick.
How does one stop the cycle?
Rick.
Especially when the unfaithful spouse is not really participating. Yes.
I think that's from a different week.
Oh, is it?
I think so.
Well, I'll be darned. That'd be the first time I've ever screwed up. Okay. This may help. Well, good. See, by adding that, we got some more questions in there. That's good. I think one of the biggest stumbling blocks for, okay. We kind of answered that one. Okay. I let what other people think of me, including my wife, dictate what I could openly divulge about my sexual addiction. As long as everything was under wraps, the guilt and shame were manageable. But now with disclosure, even though I feel a great weight has been lifted, I am still embarrassed and feel vulnerable in revealing myself to others. My seat was always one of being able to judge others. Now I'm one being judged. Humility is not one of my best character assets, comments. Just that all of us, I believe, to grow up, to get rid of our egocentric self, to get rid of to put the addict to death, so to speak, we all have to go through a series of necessary humiliations. we're going to sit there and say, this is crazy. And I think before we even begin to live in something completely different, which to me would be grace, God's grace and mercy, so that, it's, again, not about me having to do the image management. And it's true, I think that some addictions are kind of cool, gambling or, I don't know the gambling addiction school if you're a gambling addict, but some people may think it's a lesser addiction. The problem is with sexual addiction in particular, that one tends to carry a great deal of shame. And, I think that to the extent that I feel embarrassed, all I know is I have yet to really surrender my life and my will, and I'm still having trouble seeing things through a God perspective. Because if I really believe that everything that's coming to me is exactly what I need, and that it's coming from God, and these are the circumstances I'm going to need to grow, and I embrace them and accept them. When I've got that mindset, and I'm focused far more on my own defects of character and how I've impacted other people, not focused so much on what other people are thinking of me, then I'm in a good place. I just know when I'm mostly worried about what people are thinking of me, then I'm still into my pride, and there's no humility, and so that's one of the 8 lights on my dashboard that lets me know I need to really let go, because the last thing I want to do is live in that pride and let it rule my life anymore. So, let's see. The problem my mate revealed to me. I'm so tired. It's over a year from discovery now. My husband is a sex addict, and being honest, has been extremely difficult for him. Yeah, it's hard to get to that place where you can accept it and see it as a blessing and not see it as a curse. But again, it's very paradoxical. I mean, to me, my sexual addiction is my greatest gift. It's not my greatest curse. He totally withdraws into himself when he has to address something he's done wrong. He has no problem talking about others' wrongdoings. Well, yeah, because, we all want to be the world's tallest midget, right? So there may be other sex addicts, but at least I'm not as bad as them. I mean, that comparative analysis is crazy because it just, we're still trying to fortify the false self for the addict. And it's a lot easier to let it go and accept that it never was about us having to be good enough, that But really, it's just a matter of accepting God and walking with God, from my perspective. The problem my unfaithful mate seems to reveal in me is that I seem to be a stupid believer, professional forgiver, and blind to reality. Despite him appearing to be the nicest, warmest person walking on earth when everything is running smoothly, pretending normal. Well, and there are also times that life is going, well, we're not being sweet. That's not pretend normal. That's just pragmatically smart to do the right thing if things are going well. He's still keeping his secrets to himself. And I'm not asking for details. So far, I've puzzled my tiny picture of what happened with pieces that other people have disclosed to me by confronting his mismatching lies, stumbling over messages from his affair partner, etc. It's really disturbing how I seem to know more about his affair than he does. He was there. I wasn't. When I ask him, he says he can't remember or doesn't know. If it's revealed later, he admits he knew it when I first asked, but lied or chose to hide it. I would understand if I would respond badly, but I think I'm doing pretty good at handling it. I was rereading The Shocking Truth About Trust. I realized for months after disclosure, he fell into the first category of unfaithful spouses. The one you recommended isn't safe to trust, and the hurt spouse should probably run. At the same time, I was blind to that. I believed he was honestly working on our marriage. So did our two different counselors. And that doesn't mean he wasn't honestly working on a marriage. He may have honestly been working on the marriage. You may still not have been able to face his addiction. I can't truly blame them. He's very convincing. We've come a long way. Hope it's not just my naive belief. But in many ways, he's still stuck in that first category. I know he's still keeping secrets. He admits it. He says he's sorry, but doesn't want to do anything about it unless I press him. I've stopped pressing, and now he's depressed. He says it's so hard for him to say anything negative about himself. He can see how badly it affects our healing process, plus the effect on me when something new hits me out of the blue. It's really sad, because in many ways, the situation is so much better in our marriage. He says, after he's been forced to tell the truth, it makes things better for him and us. He also admits he's controlling the flow of information until he feels comfortable telling me. And I've waited and waited. He's always on the way to join an online AA 12-step program where he could disclose his issues with others in the same situation, but nothing happens. Like you say, in The Shocking Truth About Trust, it takes time. He has plenty of time to be sexual with me, but rarely time to talk about what needs to be addressed. I shared with him that I feel very unsafe with him since I don't think he'll be able to tell me if he will relapse. He admits he likely won't be able to tell as things are with him now. I tried to be understanding since I know his family usually treated problems by hiding them or pretending they don't exist. No one is allowed to do mistakes or to be broken in this perfect family, let alone admit it. For how long is it wise for me to hang on to the situation? Can you recommend anything regarding the difficulties of telling the truth? Yeah, you know, actually, I've got a really good recommendation for you. And I don't know if your husband would be willing to do this, but there is a gentleman I know that is very good at, believe it or not, he's called an accountability coach. And Bill's, let's see here, telephone number is area code 801-520-3665. And let me read that one more time. 801-520-3665. And Bill isn't just like, Bill isn't a counselor, he's a coach. But he works a lot at helping men get over shame. He's less expensive typically than most counselors, but he's a very good accountability coach. And if your husband, to me, if he can get involved with someone who can begin just talking with them, I mean, the greatest thing I had was other people, whether it was accountability, whether it was who could share with me, apart from, I think, having other people mirror this behavior for him, kind of to model it for him, he's going to have a lot of trouble because he doesn't even know how to do it. And that's one of the things that I think the 12-step groups are so helpful for. But if he's having trouble getting to an accountability or to a 12-step online group, maybe he could just make a phone call. But this is going to be about his individual work and not something that you're going to be able to fix. And I think that, you know, somebody like Bill potentially could really help him. But and if not Bill, then he needs to see some counselor that really understands addictions. Because, again, apart from doing something like that, it's going to be really difficult for him. That's why the groups are so incredibly helpful, I believe, because you've got a way of modeling it, and it takes away the shame, and being truthful becomes, at least you can learn to be truthful with yourself there, and if you can learn to do it there, maybe you can eventually even do it in your marriage.
Hey,
that's
Rick.
One of the things I was told.
Rick,
so,
I know this couple,
yes.
And they're not in the United States.
Okay.
So would these resources be accessible to somebody?
Yeah, Bill would be a great resource for him.
Okay.
Because I've got Bill. Bill does coaching with people from all over the world, Aaron.
Okay.
I mean, I've got people in Europe, and and he's perfect for that sort of situation. So I think that may be something that would be good for them.
Super. Just want to make sure they know that. If you want to send me his website, or if he has one, or his contact information, I'll make sure that it gets on this page when we post the audio.
I think what I've got here, since we're working on the call here, I'm going to send you something real quick, Aaron.
Okay.
And so I'm trying not to leave too much blank space on the call here. I just kind of keep mumbling to myself while we're doing this. Maybe. Oh, I had it there. I don't see it. So I'll have to.
I can email you
later
to remind you.
But I've got something. Mm-hmm. Yeah, you can remind me, and I'll get that on to everybody. So that would be certainly a way to go. Okay. So the next question. Could you please explain sexual anorexia as it pertains to sexual addiction? I will do my best. A lot of times, as I look at sexual anorexia, I think there are several points. One, sometimes I believe that the anorexic or anorexia is very much about someone tries to control the whole sexual thing. So what they do is they shut down everything sexual. So some sexual anorexia, I think, is in an attempt to control their sexuality, and literally they just kind of shut the whole thing down because they don't know how to have good sex or healthy sex without also it being tied into the bad sex. That's one type of sexual anorexia. There's another aspect of anorexia, I think, at times where the person's desire for what I would call healthy sex or good sex, it's almost like their clock speed to join and connect is very kind of warped because they've never really developed almost emotionally or relationally to the point where they're used to having a whole lot of intimacy. And so it really can appear that the level by which they actually begin to kind of try to come in toward another person and connect, it seems like it just almost never happens. And that's because they never think about it. All they ever thought about in their bubble was the other type of sex. And so this is also a new sort of behavior. The anorexia, though, is certainly not saying that someone is beyond the whole sexual addiction. All that's happened is they've begun to act in instead of acting out. It's still an issue of control. They're trying to control their sexuality. Now they're just trying to do it in a different way. They may not be trying to control you as much as they're trying to control them, but they're constricting as a way of kind of feeling like they're managing life. And it's difficult for someone to come to a place where they learn to really love, where they learn to really abandon themselves and are allowing themselves to really be one or to join with another person fully, to let their heart be there. And the sexual anorexic isn't moving towards health. All they're really doing is they're stopping an old behavior. It's like a dry drunk to some extent. They may not be drinking and everything, but they're not growing up. They're not moving forward. The dry drunk, in some ways, is an alcoholic anorexic, if you think about it. All they're doing is constricting alcohol, but they're still not living life. One of the things that I've always heard is there's two, in the terms clean and sober, those two words have different meanings. Clean means that someone hasn't acted out. Sober means that someone is living healthily. They're living well. They're working program. Their life is about something very different. The sexual anorexic, their life hasn't changed at all, except they're no longer doing the behavior. But they still haven't learned how to live life. One of the ways I look at it is, you know, oftentimes the addict always thinks, especially the sex addict, because, you know, they are masters of the universe, they always think that life is about them. They've yet to figure out that ultimately they were to be about life. And the sexual anorexic isn't about life. Life is still about them. They're just trying to control and manage it. Let's see. At the end of Chapter 5 video, you said some people experience symptoms of PTSD after discovery. You went on to say that those who do experience PTSD, they'll have to take extra steps and work harder to recover. We discussed this in our group call, and I'm wondering if you could elaborate on what the extra steps would be that we need to take. Great. Good question. And on this one, the steps that someone would take, especially if they're dealing more with the trauma, people that are dealing with PTSD will go typically one of two ways. They're either going to be hypervigilant, where they're always afraid, you know, it's like they're always in fight or flight, waiting for the next bomb to go off, you know, like they're in the middle of a minefield, and they all day long they're trying to control and manage and keep anything bad from happening, and they just get tired, or they're what we call avoidant. And the avoidant one, the one thing they want to do is they don't ever want to be around anything that would trigger it, make them think of it, have to think about it, don't want to talk about it. They can't hardly even face it because when they face it, what happens is they get such an incredible emotional flood. And again, the problem with PTSD, and you have to have had these symptoms for at least 3 months post where the full intensity of the emotions were happening at ground zero, still happening today, or even 6 months later. If you're still experiencing the full initial intensity, then there may be a bit of a problem if those haven't begun to subside and you become hypervigilant, or if you become avoidant and you try really hard not to ever look at it. The extra work would be going to a therapist. I think there's probably some extra therapy that needs to be involved. Where you learn to, you can, it's almost like you have to reprocess that event so that you can understand it. As I understand, or the way I try to explain this, sometimes there's so much emotion attached to that traumatic event that it prohibited kind of the prefrontal cortex or the rational part of your brain from being able to really kind of analyze it, understand it, kind of come to peace with it, and lay it all down, to lay it down as okay, we get it, and to go forward. If the amygdala, which is where that emotional center is, continues to fire at full force, it's like it never is able to get resolved. You're never able to really gain clarity because the emotions keep drowning out the rational part of the brain. There are several techniques that people use. EMDR, eye movement desensitization and reprocessing, is certainly one technique that's very popular today to deal with PTSD. It's probably the most common one used with Vietnam vets. From a spiritual perspective, some people use theophosphic to that end, and if they know somebody who's trained in that, and that's actually an old, much older technique that people have used through the centuries, which is more of an inner healing, kind of a guided meditation. And sometimes, people have used hypnosis. I'm not trying to recommend one thing or the other. I just know that if you don't figure out how to briefly shut off the feelings that you can get, let the kind of the rational part of your brain gain clarity and you begin to get perspective on it, then it's like the amygdala through the years continues to kind of run the show because you're just dealing with the emotions and it never got put to rest. And that's why the emotions continue to flood every time the PTSD gets triggered. I would say, call a therapist who deals some with trauma if you can find somebody and see if they can help walk you through it. And because once you're able to go through that, I think you'll find that the intensity of the emotional response you're having after that point will go down significantly. So does anybody have any questions after that one? Or about PTSD. Did I answer that well enough? Well, I'll assume that's a yes. So that being the case, that was our last question today. Anybody else have anything they want to ask before we get off the phone? Okay. Then I'll tell you what, we will just line up for next Monday. I hope everybody will take the time to post some questions. It's a lot more fun when we have questions to answer. Y'all did a
great
job. Rick,
are you asking me a question? Rick?
No, I wasn't trying to ask. I was just saying, did anybody else have a question they wanted to ask today?
Oh, okay. I'm going to get off the call because I've got one of the EMS participants on the phone. So y'all have a good week, and
okay.
I'll talk to you next week. Bye-bye.
Okay, guys, I will talk to you next week. Everybody have fun. Bye-bye.